Welcome to my monthly podcast titled Becoming a Sage. My name is Jan Freed, but you can call me Dr. Jan. I interview people about wisdom, how to find meaning on a daily basis, a concept I call breadcrumb legacy. I'm passionate about helping people get from where they are to where they want to be, particularly in the second half of life. I also say I'm out to retire the word retirement. We're not retiring from life, but we're moving on to something else. And as Serena has so nicely stated, we're evolving. And I believe it takes time and intentional thought to successfully move on to what's next in life. I interviewed Robert Quinn, the Margaret Elliott Tracy Collegiate Professor Emeritus at the University of Michigan, Ross School of Business. His research and writing focus on purpose, leadership, culture, and change. He is one of the co-founders of the field Positive Organizational Scholarship and a co-founder of the Ross Center for Positive Organizations. His talk on personal purpose went viral and has been viewed by over 18 million people. That is really a lot. So for more information on Dr. Quinn, please refer to the bio attached to this podcast. Now listen to our conversation about being a positive leader in a positive organization. I discovered Bob by using his book, Deep Change, Discover the Leader Within, in my leadership workshops, corporate leadership workshops. In fact, I used it with one senior leadership team and they liked the book so much, they selected it as the book for their book club for the board to read and discuss. Then I started following Bob through his blog. So welcome to the Becoming a Sage podcast, Bob.
I am so delighted to be as part of this podcast.
Okay, well, I'm honored because I interview people about wisdom, and you have really so much wisdom that we could talk forever, I think. But I'm going to start here. Since Deep Change was first published in 1996, tell us how your thoughts have changed or stayed the same, given how much change has accelerated.
When I sat down to write that book, my fingers didn't work. That is, I had the book in my head, but I couldn't type the words. And I thought, man, that's kind of strange. So I started to ponder what in the world was blocking me. And the answer was I was full of fear. I wanted to write that book. I knew to write the book, I had to become vulnerable and transparent. I had to speak from my personal experiences so as to invite people to face their own fears and to make deep change. That is not what academics do.
Right.
And suddenly,
I'm a recovering academic myself.
And I realized that I was full of fear that I would be mocked or denigrated. The moment I became clear on that, then I could ask the question, is it worth the risk? And the answer was very clear. The answer was yes. And all of a sudden, my fingers started to move and I started to write. I published the book. And in the first year, it did nothing. It just minimal sales. I was disappointed. I went on to my next project. The second year, the editor called. She said, we outsold year one. And I thought to myself, big deal. I mean, it's only one way you could go is up. And then she called the third year and she said, we've increased sales again the third year. And I said, I still was unimpressed. I said, well, why are you calling me and telling me this? And she said, you don't get it. She said, this book is a cult book. I said, a cult book? What's a cult book? She said, people who are in pain are reading this book and then they're giving it to other people and it's spreading by word of mouth. It's on an exponential growth curve. Well, it turned out that was true and it sold 100,000 copies in those next few years. The result was that I got endless emails. In fact, I just received 20 some years later. I just received one just a week ago where someone reads the book, they in fact are going through some very dark night of the soul, and they find enough wisdom in there to increase their faith, their confidence, to move their feet, and they get through the dark night of the soul. And then there's this tremendous transformation. And that's what they write and share is, you know, here's what happened. My company made it through the bankruptcy, or here's what happened. I just got promoted, or my family just accomplished this. And it's really, you know, joyful material to read when they write about that. But the book touched a lot of lives, and that brings a great deal of joy. And deep change basically is the process of personal transformation. And most specifically, it's the shift from the search for independence. That is, you know, you turn 12, puberty hits, and all of a sudden your family's not so cool. You go out there and you try to figure out who you are. And it's an ego journey. It's an attempt to figure out how to survive in the world. But then there's a point at which that journey ends and a new journey begins. And it's the journey of how to live a meaningful, contributive life, how to transcend ego. And in religion, that's called rebirth and leadership. There's other words in the general public. It's often talking about waking up, and there's just a lot of phrases. But it's a shift from I-ness to we-ness, and from acquisition to contribution. And it's a very important shift. And once we make it, we can start a new journey where we begin to learn how to do that more and more effectively over time.
So since you published that, have you changed your thoughts on anything, or would you add anything?
The answer is absolutely yes. Okay. Once you start that journey, you begin to behave in new ways. You begin to learn new lessons. Your consciousness continues to expand. You know, so I wrote Change the World, which was about Gandhi and King and others, and how they learned to become transformational influences. I wrote Building the Bridges You Walk On It, which is basically the process by which new systems emerge. It's a process of learning by faith. That's what building the bridge and walk on it means. Like when an entrepreneur builds a successful company, he didn't do it by being smart and working hard. He did it by being smart, working hard, and building the bridges he walked on it. And we can't say that afterwards. When you say, hey, how'd you become a successful CEO? He's, well, I was really smart and I worked hard.
Yeah.
That's what we expect to hear. The real answer is I built the bridges, I walked on it. Mm-hmm. And there was a number of other books. We started the field of positive organization scholarship, which asked the question, what do individuals, groups, and organizations look like at their very best? And we've had now 20 years of science trying to answer that. I recently wrote a book with Anjan Thakkar about purpose-driven organizations. How do CEOs grow up and turn from managers to leaders and then build purpose-driven organizations? And that was an exciting experience. We did a book on the best public school teachers in the state of Ohio, the top 1%. And that was a very exciting volume about what it means to become a transformational teacher. Mm-hmm. And we have them out there. They're just very rare, but you can collect them and you can learn a great deal about them. So the journey goes on and on and on. It's a very exciting journey, and it's a very enjoyable journey.
Yes, excellent. Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. Describe what is a positive organization and how can leaders create these organizations? I mean, you know, I teach leadership, but a lot of my listeners don't. So how would you describe a positive organization or a positive leader or the main, and I know we could talk forever on this, but you know, what are the main kind of concepts so people really know what you're referring to?
Well, simply put, the everyday behavior of an everyday manager in an everyday organization is driven by conventional assumptions. Those assumptions are captured in economics and all the social sciences. And the first assumption of economics is people are self-interested, rational actors. Now, why do they make that assumption? Because they study people like you and me. And much of the time, I'm in the ego state. I'm trying to survive. I'm doing what's self-interested. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to be logical. So it's about self-interest logic. The second assumption is resources are scarce. Well, that's true. Third, conflict is natural. That's true. Therefore, we live in fear. And the list goes on. There's probably 100 of those assumptions you can specify. Uh-huh. And what they paint is the conventional system. So you walk into the typical organization. What do you find? You find silos. Mm-hmm. All over the organization, there are groups of people acting in self-interested ways. And what that's doing is costing in large companies billions of dollars of wasted money because they're not pursuing the common good. And why are they not pursuing the common good? Because the CEO doesn't know how to lead. Mm-hmm. What does a leader do? A leader's highest purpose is to bring people to the purpose. That sounds like a throwaway sentence, but it's actually a profound sentence. Uh-huh. And every minute of every day, those managers are doing what they're supposed to do, solve problems. When they solve problems, they become logical. They become egotistical. The group becomes egotistical. They're seeing the small picture. Mm-hmm. Unless they are connected to the highest purpose, to the enterprise perspective, they will continue to do that. The silos will continue to spread. So the job of a leader is not to hold people accountable. It's to have the people hold themselves accountable. That's a shift from authority to inspiration. I find that sentence from a CEO who states it often. And when he states that sentence, he makes people crazy. They say, you can't ask me that. Don't ask me to have my people hold themselves accountable because you're asking me to step out of ego-driven logic. What you're asking me to do is inspire people. I don't know how to inspire people. There was no class that right. I took in my MBA program uh-huh. on inspiration. Mm-hmm. I know how to solve logical problems. That's what I do. So conventional organizations, we all know them.
Yes.
They look like what I just described. A purpose-driven yes. organization, you walk in and you see people collaborating at a very high level. You see them accomplishing things that are exponentially better than their sister organization. And the people are highly unified, highly animated, and they're co-creating a better future, and they love it, and they're filled with hope. Mm-hmm. It's a fundamentally different organization. Now, people say, there is no such system. I get all over the world, everywhere I go, mm-hmm. I get pushback because people have internalized learned helplessness. They do not want to hear that message. It's absolutely threatening to them. And so they say, I can't do that in my organization. We're a blank organization. Fill in the blank. Or I have this kind of boss. I could never do this. And so they can't. So, but the argument, there is no such thing that they make, is a false argument, because for every 100 organizations, one of them is purpose-driven, whether it's a full company or 100 units in a company. It's rare, but it's real. And if even one case existed on the planet, the theory of learned helplessness doesn't hold. So that's what a purpose-driven organization looks like.
Yeah, excellent. Wow. What your talk on how to find purpose in your life went viral. You know, congratulations. Purpose is so critical to living a meaningful life. Tell us how to find purpose. And I know that this, you know, I'm asking you to do a, you know, 18-minute TED talk in, you know, a few minutes here. But, you know, really, purpose has gained so much, you know, visibility, you know, as a result of COVID, I think, because really, you know, the whole Great Resignation, I think, gave people time to think about, rethink their lives. You know, is this what I want to be doing? You know, is this how I want to spend my time? So anyway, just talk to us about that, because
I think that COVID put an exclamation point on a larger process that's been going on for a long time.
Okay.
That is, we are experiencing exponential growth in technology. I can't pick up my phone and look at the headlines without one of the headlines being, today, this company introduced this new technology. It's an explosion. We have knowledge coming in just incredible rate. And so that's driving change at a rate we've never seen. Now, for 70 years, we've been predicting this, but now we're living in it. We really are living in permanent white water. I get phone calls from CEOs all the time about this problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of them said, okay, I've got COVID as a problem. I've got Russia as a problem. I've got inflation as a problem. These are big problems. But if I solve any one of those, it'll be immediately replaced by a new one. That is, we are living in permanent white water. Now, the whole world is doing that. Now, what happens when you're in permanent white water? You panic. You live in fear. What's the evidence of that? Well, look at our political systems, not just in the United States, but across the world. We have parties living in high incivility,
right,
condemning each other while they enact the problem. We have a tilt towards populist, fascist-leaning kinds of leaders.
Yes.
All over the world, not just in the United States,
right,
where we're saying, please give me a savior. Give me this political leader who's going to solve these problems. The political leader will gladly take that power, but he's not going to solve the problem. And so we're living in permanent white water. And intuitively, we know that we have to find meaning. And the meaning comes with finding purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been going in the opposite direction for 30 or 40 years. I read a thing yesterday from the Chronicle of Education. In 1960, 85% of the people checked off an answer. In going to college, I hope to find a philosophy, a meaningful philosophy of life. By 2000, 73% had checked off the item, I'm going to college to get a job,
mm-hmm,
to make a lot of money. We've watched an evolution that has put us very much into an ego perspective. We've lost purpose and meaning everywhere we turn. Institutions are collapsing, all kinds of institutions, because they can't provide meaning inside or outside the institution. That's a failure of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we leave the leaders and talk about you and I, there's a thirst. When that video went viral, I was inundated with emails. And they came from places I didn't know existed around the world. And from these beautiful, simple people. And for example, one person wrote, she said, I've had many, many surgeries. I have 3 years to live. I have no face. But in the 3 years that I have to live, I would like to make those years as meaningful as possible. I want to find my purpose. You read that and your heart melts.
Right.
And there are people all over the world hungry for purpose. Even people who claim they're not are hungry for purpose.
Yeah.
So then you ask the question, how do you find it? And that is a big answer. There's a lot of ways you can get help on it. You can go on the internet with that question, and there's a billion systems where people tell you. But basically, it means looking within.
Mm-hmm.
It means saying, what are the most important experiences of my life? What are the 10 best things that ever happened to me? What are the 10 worst things that ever happened to me? If I take those 20 things and examine them carefully, what has life prepared me to do that no one else can do? That's a transformational question. The moment you ask that question, these 10 terrible things that depressed you to write them down are suddenly transformed. They're teachers. They've been helping me become who I really am. So what are the lessons there? Well, there's 20 other exercises you can do, but it's a matter of searching and saying, Picasso put it like this. He said, the second most important day of your life is when you discover your highest gift. The most important day of your life is when you decide to give it away.
Mm.
Well, that's what higher purpose is about. Who am I? What are my gifts? And how do I best give those away so that the rest of the universe gets elevated? Now, the moment you find that and you commit to that, you are now living in a different state. You're living in what I call the fundamental state of leadership. And you're living in a different way, and you're having different quality of experiences, and you're growing at a much higher rate. That's what people are looking for. They're hungry for. We have so few people that are able to help them get what they're looking for.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's definitely powerful. And I know you mentioned you've written a lot of books, and my listeners, you know, they vary in age and they vary. And, you know, many people are kind of what I would say post-career. So they're looking for meaning and purpose. Which one of your books should they read? What would you recommend first?
Well, I think the last book, it's called The Economics of Higher Purpose.
Oh.
In the early chapters, we talk about personal purpose and how to find your purpose. So they could look at that, be helpful. In the chapters that follow, we talk about what we learned from interviewing 30 CEOs of purpose-driven companies.
Okay.
And we talk about how you can bring purpose to a relationship, a group, a team, an organization. And that really is, that was a delight to work on because there were so many counterintuitive insights that came to us. So I think people at that stage could read that book and probably get a lot of personal level and collective level wisdom from it.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Legacy is my passion topic.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you define legacy? And when I say legacy, what's the story that comes to mind?
Let me share with you an experience that I create for every group of executives that I teach.
Okay.
As I said, when I point out the fruit of the science of positive organization scholarship, it gives us the purpose-driven organization. And the reaction is, no, that can't be true. That's not true. Let me tell you about my ego-driven world. So they're very defensive of that notion, and even more defensive of the notion of transformational leadership, that you and I need to be transformational leaders. We need to elevate the thinking, transform the mindsets of the people around us. So there's tremendous resistance. And it took me years to come up with this exercise to penetrate that resistance. But here's the exercise. I ask everybody in the room to identify the one person in their life who left the most positive legacy in their life. Now, it might be your mother. It might be your third grade teacher. Might be your coach in high school. Might be your first boss. Who left the most positive legacy in your life? Now, what I'd like you to do is to take 2 minutes and pair up with another person. Take 2 minutes and tell them about your person so the person comes to life. The second 2 minutes, they're going to tell you about their person.
Mm-hmm.
The third 2 minutes, I want you to ask the question, what do these two people have in common? So they get 6 minutes.
Sure.
Then I debrief them and I say, tell me what they had in common. I list all the characteristics on the board. Then I take the characteristics and I put every one of them into one of four categories. And the four categories are idealized influence or selfless service. Number two is individualized consideration or genuine concern. Number three is inspirational motivation or the ability to link someone to an inspiring future. And number four is intellectual stimulation, or the ability to challenge people to think for themselves. Those are four statistical factors that hold across the world in the science of transformational leadership. Now, they look at that, they find that sort of awe-inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And then I point out that I played a trick on them. In most business schools, if you talk about transformational leadership, the slide goes up with a picture of Gandhi or some prime minister or some world-renowned person, at which point the people in the class immediately do this. They put up their arms and say, "I'm not Gandhi. I can't be. Besides that, Gandhi didn't get along with his son," or "Jack Welch cheated on his wife," or they immediately list some flaw
mm-hmm.
in whoever you put up, because they don't want this theory to be true. Now, I say the trick I just played on you is I didn't put up Jack Welch or Gandhi. I just put up your mother, your coach, your third grade teacher. These are not Time Magazine people. These are people in your life. And so the first point is, all around us, transformational people are rare, but frequent. All around us, there are such people, and you've already had them in your life. Your mother transformed your life, or your coach did. You can't ever forget it. You're deeply grateful for them. So number one is they exist. The next question is, should you pay it forward? If your mother did that for you, or your coach did that for you, do you have any accountability to pay that forward into the lives of the people around you? Now, at that point, you can watch their paradigms change. The defensiveness melts. The mind opens. The heart opens. We begin to explore how to do that. But until you get past the defensiveness
mm-hmm.
that is a part of the conventional model that we all carry, then you don't make much progress, because logic does not take people into the transformational realm. It requires more than logic.
Yeah, that is absolutely beautiful. That is a great example and exercise. And I have my leadership students write their own eulogies. And not obituaries, because that's kind of common. But and when I started this, the two were really kind of distinct. Now they're kind of blending. But, you know, to get them to think about, well, if that's how you want to be remembered, then you need to start living your life like that right now. So excellent, Bob. Well, we're kind of coming to an end here. And I always like to ask my interviewees, what else should I have asked that my listeners need to know?
What your listeners need to know is to ask a crucial question in every situation. And the question is this: what result do I want to create? People laugh. They say, "I already asked that." And I say, "No, you don't. The question that you ask is, how do I get what I want?" There's a dramatic difference between the two questions. Robert Fritz taught us that the moment you ask the question, what result do I want to create, and you answer it, that's the hard part, because most of the time we don't know. But if you answer it, you immediately create an in tension, a tension between what is and what should be, like your people and their eulogy.
Mm-hmm.
If they embrace that future, the only thing they can do now is to begin to make personal change. That is to begin to step into uncertainty and learn by faith, become a new person. The question, what result do I want to create, is a transformational question. When you learn to ask it of yourself, you learn to transform yourself. Once you do that, you can learn how to ask it of other people, and you have to learn, because those people don't know how to answer it. You ask it, and then you help them answer it.
Mm-hmm.
The moment they actually answer it, you now transform the relationship, the marriage, the team, the community, or the organization. Purpose is a transformational force. And that's what I hope your listeners will remember.
I've learned so much from all these podcasts, and I particularly learned a lot from you. So, you know, you've got me thinking about my graduate course and all kinds of relationships. Well, it's been a great conversation. Bob, my focus is on helping people make the rest of life the best of life. So may the rest be the best for you.
Thank you so very much.